to Proverbs chapter 20, verse 21. Okay? And it says, an estate that is quickly acquired at first, afterwards it'll not be a blessing. Okay, is that basically what your translation say?
Ahab, an inheritance may be acquired hastily at the beginning, but its end shall not be blessed.
Fine. Okay. Means when you acquire something quickly in the physical world, like money. Okay? Now Rashi says an interesting thing. He gives an illustration. He says, for example, the 2.5 tribes that wanted to stay on the other side of the Jordan. Okay? Now their job was to go and fight in the war for the land during the time that there would be a war, and then they would come back to the land. So they said, so Rashi says they were very quick to take their portion on the other side of the Jordan, and they spoke very quickly, because it says, it states in the verse in Numbers 32, it says, corrals for our sheep and our cattle we will build, and cities for our children we'll make.
What verse is that?
It doesn't say the verse here in Rashi. It just says
okay.
Chapter 32. You'll have to find the verse.
Okay.
So he says, they made the essence secondary, because they preceded their sheep to their children. Okay? That's what Rashi says is the first half of the verse. The second half of the verse, when it says, and afterwards there'll be no blessing, he says, because they were exiled many years prior to the other tribes. They were part of the 10 tribes. They were exiled before the rest of the 10 tribes. And that's it. Like, it brings a proof from history or something. I'm not sure exactly where it is from, but he brings his proof for that. Okay? That's how Rashi is learning the pasuk. Alright, the verse. Now, there are two questions. One question is, first of all, what does Rashi mean? And secondly, after we see what Rashi means, it doesn't sound like it really fits into the verse. Okay, so we have to see how Rashi applies to the verse. Those are the two questions. Is that clear?
An interesting correlation. Is that how we're going to study it, from Numbers and from Proverbs, right?
That's right. Rashi brought it together. So first we want to understand what Rashi is saying. And after we understand what Rashi is saying, then we have to understand how that fits into the verse.
That's chapter 32, verse 15 in Numbers.
Oh, thank you very much, Shirley. That's very good. Okay? Is that clear? Any questions? Okay. So the thing is like this. Rashi says that they stated, that all they did was state they stated the one before the other. They stated the animals before their family. Okay? But they didn't do anything wrong. It doesn't say they did anything wrong. It's only they said the wrong order. Okay? Right? Now the thing is that, so what's wrong with that? What would you say is wrong with that?
Or your priorities are.
Absolutely. That's the exact word I was looking for. Priorities. You have the wrong priorities. I'd like to tell you a story. I think that will help us understand here. When I was a kid, in the Jewish world at that time, it was the second generation after a wave of Jews came over. Okay, a wave of Jews came over from Europe, and I was living, I was a child basically, towards like the, when the second generation had grown up and started, you know, coming out into the world. Okay? Now the thing is, the first generation that came over from Europe basically kept the Torah. The second generation was a washout. I mean, hardly anybody. I mean, a lot of people in that generation did not keep the Torah. They fell away. The whole, like practically the whole generation. And the question is, I mean, what happened between the first generation and the second generation? That was the big question. At the time, I remember hearing as a kid, as a teenager, basically, when I could understand, and basically this was many times discussions, few times this discussions came up that I heard. One of the answers that I heard was from Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay, he was the greatest leader in the past generation. And he said what destroyed the second generation was the kvetch. You know what a kvetch is?
No.
Like, ugh. You know, like, you're like, you're bothered by something. Ugh. You know, like, if something is really bothering you, you make a sound that shows, that you're, that something terribly wrong. Right?
Right.
Right. You know what I mean? You go, ah. You're like, a terrible thing, like a catastrophe. What is the kvetch? What was the kvetch? What was this, thing? See, when they sat at the Sabbath table, so the Jews that, the parents that had come over, the father would say, boy, my competitor is open on Shabbos and he's making a mint. If I could only keep the store open on Shabbos, I mean, boy, that would really, I could really make it. But I'm losing so much money. So every Shabbos when he couldn't make money, every Sabbath when he couldn't make money, he would kvetch, he would complain. He'd complain about it. The mother would complain that she has to buy meat from the kosher butcher, and that costs much, much more than the supermarket. And she would complain if she can only buy, from the supermarket. You see? Now the children were brought up with the wrong priority system. You see? They picked up the parents lived the true life. They lived the life of Torah. But they were in conflict. You see? And there was a part of them that held the priority was making the money. But they lived the life of Torah. But there was a part of them at priority. You see? Now, but the second generation picked up that priority, and they turned away from Torah. You see. Now the same thing here. The first generation of the I don't know how many years it was from the time they took their land till the destruction of the temple. You have to remember this was at the time of Joshua. That it was first of all at the time of Moses at the end. They agreed to this agreement. And then that's when they actually said it, at the time of Moses. Now, that was towards the end already, when Moshe was leaving his mission. And Joshua was going to take over. So from Joshua to the destruction of the temple, I don't know how many hundreds of years it is. You understand? But the fact is, I don't know the dates, but the fact is, over that amount of time, it's passed on from generation to generation, the incorrect priorities, and the children take it on to a higher level and to a worse level than the prior generation, you see? And each one takes the next step. So the thing is that's what Rashi is, He's saying that people, that parents do the correct act, but sometimes there's a certain view within them that shows you're doing the right thing, but the priorities are slightly messed up. You see? And that priority, many times, I'm not saying all the time, but many times the children will pick up. And that is what that is what Rashi is saying. Any questions? Is that clear? Now the question is, so how does that fit into Rashi? I mean, how does that fit into the verse? The verse is like this. When somebody is very quick because of his priorities, in other words, his priorities make him maneuver in a way that he's quick to get something. In other words, like this. Let's say you have to make a living and you have to learn Torah. The question is, what framework is your life in? There are certain people that their framework is making money. They find time to learn. There's certain people that their framework is learning, the study of Torah, but they have to make a living. Both are doing the same thing. They're both learning, and they're both working. But the priorities are very, very different. Depending on which framework you put it in, the priorities are very, very different between these two people. And because of that, the children will pick up two different lifestyles. That's what he's saying. He's saying when you're quick because of your priorities put one thing slightly before the other because of the priorities. You're quicker to make a living. In this case, it's quicker to make a living than taking care of their children. In the case that I gave, it's quicker to make a living than learning Torah. In the case of Reb Moshe, it was keeping mitzvahs, the priority of mitzvahs versus the priority of making a living. They didn't do anything wrong. But the priorities in their life showed up, and that's what their children picked up. That's what Rashi is saying. Any questions?
Mostly conveyed through your actions, then, by what you say?
Well, it's by what you say, yeah. In other words, I'm not talking about a person that lives an incorrect life. That goes without saying. But here, a person lives the correct life, but when he says, when he's very quick, it means that one thing which is not the ultimate takes a slight priority over the other. You see? Which is the wrong priority. In other words, where the wrong priority takes priority over the correct priority. But you have both things. Any human being has to live both ways. You have to keep the commandments, and you have to make a living. And you have to satisfy your working conditions, and you have to satisfy you and protect your family. You have to do both. You see? You have to study Torah, and you have to make a living. I mean, all these things are both correct. But just because you do both doesn't mean you have your priorities on straight. That is a certain view. And the problem shows up. It's amazing. Going to Rashi, the problem will show up in the children.
So you're saying that the priority is to make a living, but watching other people, you may deviate a little bit from what would be the correct way, like maybe keeping open on Shabbat or something like
that. You're right. Keeping open on Shabbat would be totally wrong. That doesn't have anything to do with priorities. That's a wrong act. You see? That's not what I'm saying.
Well, I thought I wondered if you were saying that, but then you mentioned that, and so these people that were watching what was going on, that they weren't doing, was it more or less maybe priority isn't necessarily the word in what I'm trying to say. It would be kind of an observation view that there were a little bit of jealousy there.
Jealousy? Where do you see jealousy?
In that the other guy was making more money because he could stay open on Shabbat.
Right, there was definitely jealousy, that's true. But the only thing is it bothered him. In other words, he still kept the mitzvahs.
Right.
And he did not open on Shabbos.
But his speech was what the kids heard.
That's right, they heard the complaining.
Right.
They heard the complaint, which showed that his priorities was money, but something was forcing him to keep the mitzvahs. But there was a certain priority which they sensed. The same thing over here. Here was more subtle with the 2.5 tribes. It was a little more subtle, Because there they built the corrals and they built the cities to protect their families before they went to war, you see. Now, they did both, but the thing is that their priority was the corrals. A little a sense that that came prior to the, even though they did both, but the priority was one over the other. The same thing with a person might sit and learn Torah. I know a lot of people, they learn Torah and they go out to work. But if you really want, you really see, you can really see in people that they're really two distinct priority systems. One of the system is making money. That's his priority. But he also learns Torah. In the framework of making a living, he learns. There's another person that his framework is learning Torah, but he realizes he has to make a living. That is two different people. But the act is the same. I'm saying the act could be exactly the same. In other words, let's take the case of there could be a family that kept Torah, and they're very happy to keep Torah. They lost out on a certain money, but they may do, because the main thing was keeping Torah. Now, they did the same thing that the other person did that kept Torah, but complained. They did the exact same thing. So, therefore, the action is the same. The only difference is in your priorities. They're quick to make a move. They're quick to make a move for the... that's what I mean. It's quick because the priority is one over the other. That's the quickness, but not the action. Not the action. The action is not incorrect. That's the way I understand Rashi.
Do we establish priorities on our own initiative? What I'm thinking is, aside from money, there are many different types of inheritance. And you inherit principles. You inherit a way of life. You inherit these kind of things. Now, if you work at it and you acquire it on your own, then I assume from that then that there will be a blessing. But now, if there is none, and somebody hands it to you, or it's too easy, then the priority system hasn't been acquired yet.
Right. Let me explain, Bill. Let me explain. When a person starts out in life, his priorities and his philosophy and his ways of life is basically he received from his parents.
Right.
Okay? Now, through the study of Torah, a person has to investigate. Through the help, first you have to study the ideas of Torah, and the Torah teaches you how to investigate your own personality.
Right.
Okay? Now then you have to investigate your own personality to undo the incorrect ideas and the incorrect priorities. Okay? That type of person is a rare person. You don't find many of those type of people in any generation. Most people pick up their priorities from their parents. If they're lucky, they have good parents and they pick up good priorities and they live their life pretty good. Some people pick up certain things. They live not a bad life, but the priorities are slightly off. So therefore, the children, what happens is in a generation where most people, their personality and their perspective comes from the generation before, you see. So therefore, they have a... Therefore, that generation affects the next generation. The only way to undo that is to become a thinker in Torah, spend many hours learning Torah, and to learn how to think correctly about these ideas, to learn how to think correctly altogether, that comes first, and then to think about these ideas, and then slowly change your priorities and make them your own that you see to be true based on your ideas. That is the rare person. That's the Talmud Chacham. That's the wise person. That's the righteous person. Where on his own he made that step.
All right, then why is it that the second generation of Jewish people that came over, as you mentioned, wouldn't acquire some priority system from their parents?
Because the thing is, the parents that complained, and most of that generation did complain. Well, that's what the children picked up.
Okay.
That the priority was the money, but something was stopping them from doing that. They had certain religious feelings. So therefore, they kept the religion, but there was a priority to make money, which they showed in the complaint.
Okay. I got it.
Okay?
So what is the priority, and I understand what you're saying about that, have to do with a sudden inheritance?
Sudden inheritance means, I think it means acquiring land too quickly. In other words, by quickly he means that you're quicker to relate to the land and the estate and your inheritance than the other areas of life. In other words, let's say a wise person or a righteous person would inherit a lot of money. It would not change his life any, because his life is a life of Torah and a life of justice, you see? So therefore, the money would fit into the his framework of Torah. But a regular person, even if he learns Torah, but because his priority is money, the money would have a great effect on him. It would affect his personnel. That's what it means quickly. It's quicker. He acquires the thing prior that he has his priorities correct. In other words, a wise person many times stays in the yeshiva before he goes out to work for many, many years. He studies in the seminary for years, even if he gets married and lives a poor life. Then at a certain point, he moves out. But it's after he has his priorities straight. But he doesn't have his priorities straightened out and he goes out into the world, he could be in trouble. Certain framework, you know what I mean?
I got you. Thank you.
If it's not gotten hastily, might be okay.
That's right. We're not against wealth.
Yeah.
But we're for is a life of, in other words, you could be wealthy and you can enjoy life, but the only thing is you must have your priorities straightened out. If you start enjoying life or go for money very quickly, before you have your priorities straightened out, then you're in trouble. That's what it means quickly. By quickly, it means that you acquire money before you have your priorities straightened out. Then it's very dangerous. We're going to go back now to verse 20, okay? We just did 21, we're going to go back to 20. It says, he who curses his father or his mother, the lights go out. His lights go out, and he remains in utter darkness. Okay? That's the verse. Now, okay? Any questions?
No. I'm sorry, Rabbi, my book flipped. We're in 20.
We're in chapter 20, verse 20.
Okay. Whoever curses his father, his mother, his lamp shall be put out in the blackest darkness.
Right. Utter darkness, it means. Okay, you're right. Now, the question is, what does it mean his lamp will be put out? Now, it doesn't mean his lamp is there. You mean, if you curse your father, the lights don't go out in your house, right? But the thing is by lights, it always means knowledge, how you see things, how you understand things, represents Torah. The light is a guide to see the truth. Utter darkness means that you'll have no view of truth at all. Okay? Now, that's what the verse is saying. So if somebody curses his father or his mother, then he will never be able to see the truth. He has no ability to see the truth. Okay? Now the question is why? Is it because he's just not keeping a commandment? There are people that don't keep a commandment. They have some view, some of them have some true ideas, and they could repent, they could come back here, they're like, the guy's totally lost. And if you're going to say it's because of not honoring, you know, by cursing, by the way, it means like disgrace, either to their face or about them, you know what I mean, you disgrace them. So the thing is the question is, why is cursing your father or mother have to do, what does that have to do here? Well, why does that bring about total destruction of being able to see truth and true ideas? That's the question.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that child and parent are one?
What do you mean they're one?
Well, somehow they're connected.
Yeah, they might be connected, but let's face it, they're a separate person. They have their own free will, and they live their own lives. I mean, there's a certain way you affect them, like we showed in the last word that we discussed. There's certain ways that you affect your children. But your children still have, your children have different parents than you had, so they're a different person. And how they view you is also, you know what I mean, it's a different person.
But they somehow have been the authority in your life.
Well, your parents are definitely an authority in their life, that's correct. Well, why should that have anything to do with it? I mean, I understand that we have to honor our parents, but why should it cause this? That's the problem. Why should it cause this?
There could be a motive, and there could be a motive, a reason for the curse. There could be something that...
Well, it doesn't seem to make a distinction. It's just saying, if you curse your parents, that's it. It's all over with.
Well,
you live in utter darkness insofar as truth is concerned.
No, but you curse them for... Wouldn't you have a reason for doing that?
Whatever the reason. It doesn't say... It doesn't make a distinction between reasons. It just says cursing them.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well. Right. Would you like me to take one step?
Can I try one thing first?
Sure, please.
It would seem to me that your father and your mother are, in essence, a large portion of your cause for existence.
Right.
So if you are going to curse that...
By cause, you mean physical existence?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're going to curse that and wish it had not happened...
Right.
Then you are... denying the natural sort of cause and effect process that even got you here. And if you're going to deny that, then it would seem like understanding the truth about the way the universe works and the way God has set it up would be beyond your capability, because that seems like a basic cornerstone.
Yeah, but the only thing is, let's say I don't keep Shabbos. I mean, it's also a basic cornerstone.
But I tried to say, Doug.
Let's say I don't keep Shabbos. That's a cornerstone of our religion. Let's say, you know, I mean, there are many things that are basic cornerstones. Why is this cornerstone any different?
Because this one is a causative factor for your existence.
All you're telling me is I'm a person that does not have appreciation. I don't appreciate what somebody does for me, right? But you're telling me that that's going to cause me, a person that lacks appreciation, causes him not to be able... to gain any type of learning. Why?
No, I don't think it's appreciation.
Oh, you don't think so? What is it?
No, I mean, you could be, you know, really upset at your parents because, I don't know, the way they treated you or something else.
Right.
But you've got to recognize that in God's scheme of things, that is the means by which he brought you into existence.
Are you saying that God comes down and takes away your ability to think straight?
No.
And then how does it work?
What I'm saying is that by denying or essentially cursing your own existence...
I'm not cursing my own existence. I'm cursing my parents' existence.
Yeah, but if you're cursing your parents' existence, you're essentially cursing your own existence.
It's true. I'm making a mistake. It's a wrong thing to do. I'm making a mistake. Let's say I don't keep Sabbath. I mean, it's a mistake, but I mean, did that blind me to live in utter darkness? People make mistakes. There's no such thing as repentance.
Well, I'm presuming the verse is not talking about if you repent of it.
Yeah, I understand. So then anything you don't keep, I mean, if you stop keeping mitzvah, so then you're also dead. I mean, if you don't repent, so then it's all over in anything you don't do.
No, because what I want to argue is that there's a qualitative difference between your cursing your parents and every other mitzvah.
I understand, but I want to know what's the difference. Why does one cause utter darkness and one doesn't?
Because if I don't keep Shabbos,
right,
then that's an act I choose to do or not to do.
That's correct.
But if I curse my parents, They are the causative effect of my even being in existence.
So what? So I have the wrong idea. Now let's say that guy decides to hear, how would I repent on Shabbos? Somebody would teach me the correct idea of the Sabbath, or he would tell me, teach me the correct idea of God, and he'll straighten me out. Now why can't I do that if I curse my parents?
You think the verse is saying that it's impossible to undo that?
Let's put it this way. I'm saying that that's a more destructive type of thing than the other one. Whether you could do repent or not, I really don't know. We'll have to discuss it and see how far, you know, when we discuss it, we'll see how far you could go or not. But it's really, I think there's a real big difference, not just a quantitative difference, but a real qualitative difference. How you think. In your thinking process.
Maybe you better proceed on then.
I say there are two types of wrongdoings. There's one wrongdoing, let's say I'm stingy, right? So I have a wrong view of money. I will make mistakes in money, but I'll have another areas I could think correctly. But there's certain diseases that affect the mind itself. That, how are you going to get out of that? You understand? In other words, there's certain diseases, every disease of the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, the emotions, affect our thinking process. But some of them affect us in a particular area. Like stinginess will affect me in a particular area. But your relationship with your parents will affect you in an essential manner. Very essential manner. In other words, essential to the process of thinking clearly. While stinginess will not affect your ability to think clearly, it'll only affect you in the area of money. It'll affect you, but in every other area you'll be able to think correctly. See the difference?
I see it, but and I guess that's what I was getting at, but I'm also not clear on what the
on how it works. How it works, right? I'm just setting up those two types of things.
Okay.
I like to show you how it works. Okay. When a person relates to his parents, there are two extremes how he could relate to his parents. One extreme, parents represent authority, and they become authority in your life, throughout your life. In other words, they represent the ultimate in your authority life. Okay? Now, in learning, you must be able to think on your own and simultaneously learn from an authority. If a person can't learn from an authority, he can't gain in learning. If a person can't think on his own, he's not free to think on his own, then he also can't learn. Okay? Now, if a person cannot accept his parents to the level where he will degrade them, disgrace them, to go out to hurt them, means he cannot accept an authority. Whatever the authority says, he can't accept it. Because of that, you can't gain in learning, because learning must come through a teacher. If you can't relate to a teacher, then you can't gain in learning. On the other hand, if you're so dominated by the parents that you have to give in, like a person that's totally subjugated by society, can't do anything different than what the society says. That person can't think, because any time he tries to think, he has to have questions against the society. He can't think. It'll affect anything he does. He must do it according to society. So he can't think. So I'm saying these two extremes affect the mind totally.
So you're using mother and father here mostly as an authoritative...
Exactly. If you are dominated, if you cannot tolerate authority, or you're totally dominated by authority, then there's no thinking process in either person. What there has to be in the person, something in between. There has to be a respect for authority, yet let's put it this way, we're not talking about a thinker. I'm talking about a child, a teenager, before he becomes a thinker. He has to be raised in such a way that he has a certain amount of rebellion and a certain amount of acceptance of authority. He has to have both. So that he can maneuver between the two to be able to learn from the person yet to think independently whether he should accept it, every idea based on the idea.
That happens basically or somewhat by the attitude of parents, I know.
That's true. Some people totally control the child in every single aspect of their life. There's no freedom. That's very dangerous. Because once you control the child to that much, either the child is going to rebel, and they won't try and they won't accept what you have to say, or they're going to be totally dominated by you. You see? Now, what has to happen to really be a thinker somehow has to come out somehow to be evenly keeled between the two, to have enough ability to accept authority, but enough freedom to rebel, so that when your mind sees, this is only when you start, of course, once you become a wise person, then you get above this altogether and you just follow ideas. The idea becomes the whole important thing. But until you get to that level, you must be raised in such a way that you have a little bit of rebellion. It's a dangerous game, because you're giving your child a lot of freedom. You see what I mean? To be able to think on his own and to be free and to differ than the parent, he'd come out different than what you want. It could be. That's why a lot of parents want to totally control their children, because they want to make sure that the child doesn't come out anything different than exactly what they want. And they do get that, but the child is not going to be a thinker.
Condemnation here is as much towards the parent as it is towards the parent's child.
Well, the thing is, the verse is only talking about the nature of a person. The verse is not talking about how to raise a child to bring it about. But he's telling that is a defect, a person that's daily set aside of rebellion. Where the rebellion is so strong that he can't accept authority, then the verse is saying that he will not be able to think straight. The lights go out. There's no real thinking, because he can't accept an authority. You see? And on the other hand, I'm saying that if you're totally dominated by the authority, then you also can't think on your own. You can't think freely on your own either. Somehow you have to control the child, but allow him enough latitude and enough freedom that he could be independent to a certain extent. That rebellion, you have to allow it. You have to allow it out.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
That's a really nice idea.
Right. It's interesting. It's difficult. You have to ask the question how to raise a child now.
Yeah.
A little late here.
A little late for me too, right.
I hope we're not too late.
That's right. You're not too late. You can still work it out.
It does put the parents in a strata all by themselves. And I don't mean an overly respective, but maybe it was God's plan to emphasize the fact that the parents, mother and father, have a very deep responsibility.
Well, I don't know what God's plan is. All I'm telling you is what the facts are. I'm just telling you the facts. I don't know what God's plan is here. You know what I mean? I can't go into God's plan.
Well, according to what I read in Scripture.
Right.
Okay.
Shirley, could you ask that question again? Shirley?
Yes. We thought that we would talk a little bit about the repentance of this person that has
this problem.
Yes.
Okay. Now, that's what Doug said before. What about repentance?
Right.
Repentance means, in this case, that I have the ability to say now I'm going to and accept an authority over me. In other words, you must have a teacher to train you, to open your mind. You must accept some authority, you see? So therefore, but the person can't accept, and there's nothing within him that would allow him to accept. If there's something within him that allows him to accept, then it's not to the extent that the verse is talking about.
So you think that verse says, I'm coming to this conclusion, that what you think is that we have gone beyond the point of knowing, of having any repentance.
In other words, there are certain people that their mind is destroyed from the time they were raised by either bringing out, I don't know how, but they have either by being brought out total rebellion or total acceptance. There must be a certain quantity of the other side to be able to make it. There's too much, and I don't know, I can't tell you exactly what point, but there is a point of no return when you rebel to such a point that you can't get back.
Well, let me say this then.
I'll give you an illustration. You know, during the Vietnam War, they had those seven guys that were on trial. They rebelled against the whole government. If you remember, it was back...
Chicago 7.
What?
The Chicago 7.
That's right. Now, the thing is, after it was all over, later on, you know, you read stories, what happened to them. Six joined the society, six of them. They got the rebellion out of them, but they had another side to accept society. One of them couldn't. He was always looking for causes to rebel. That was his nature. To find causes to rebel. That's already, you know what I mean? That guy, I don't know if you could talk to the guy. I don't know if you could ever reach the guy. The other guys, maybe you could. Maybe. You understand? At least they have a chance, because the other side, you see, was there. There was a certain respect that they did have for, so they got their, they sowed their wild oats, and then they went the other way. They're both. You see? But once you have it that bad that you have to keep looking for causes to rebel, and that's your existence is rebelling and cursing all authority by, I'm going to curse your father and mother, I'm saying you cannot accept any authority. That's what I'm saying.
Well, if they came and sat in your class and listened to some of the talk here...
Who came in my class?
Pardon?
Well, you said, if who came in my class?
They're these people that had cursed their parents.
Yeah, it's, then I don't think they wouldn't be able to listen. They would scream and yell at me.
You don't think that... you think that nothing anybody would say even would venture in?
I think there's a certain point where you can't.
Oh.
There's a certain point where you can... But very, very difficult. Very, you know. But it depends on what the quantity is. As the quantity moves, there's a certain point where the mind is so affected, the very essence of thinking is destroyed in one or two extremes. You have to be a little bit towards the middle. You have to have both to be able to make it in the world of learning.
If you've cut off your ability to look at, to accept information from any outside source, you're in real trouble.
That's right, exactly. Whatever they say has to be wrong because you're always looking for a war. Like, you can't make it. How are you going to make it? There's no basis to make it on. And on the other hand, if your mind can't work because you're totally subdued to society and to authority, so then you can't be a free thinker. You can't argue with them. So you also can't make it. I'm saying you have to have a little bit of both. Someplace along the line, you have to have the ability to have both.
So this verse talks about, is it a single? Is it an attitude? Is it something they say? They defame?
Well, it could be that the verse is saying there's certain statements that a person makes that you might be able to tell how far it is. I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but I don't know. Let's put it this way. If I would have looked at the older Chicago 7, I would say there's no hope for them. But I would be wrong, because you see, 6 did have something within them that they could accept the society. The other one couldn't make it. He was very unhappy. He was so unhappy that he committed suicide, but he couldn't join society. Total rebellion is a very, very unhappy state.
And you curse without using it verbally?
It's an idea. I don't care. See, I'm more interested in the idea that when a rebellion, where there is no sense of accepting society, where the nature is that you must find the cause to rebel against, then there's no hope for that person. When a person can't think in any other way except the authority that he has accepted over him, whether it's society or a person or a group of people, whatever it is, once he's accepted that authority over him, there's a certain point where you can't think freely anymore.
Okay, now back to the thinker. A thinker, a person that has not been adversely affected in this case, a thinker is one then that is willing to and always listens to opposition or other people's ideas.
We're talking about a person that's starting out in his studies, okay? Now, there are certain areas that he won't listen to, like the stingy person might not listen to areas of true ideas about how to operate with money. He might not accept that. But if you tell him other ideas, you find ideas that he could see clearly. And then once you straighten out his thinking process, then he'll be able to deal with stinginess.
Okay, well, you said that was a beginner. Now, supposing we're just talking about a thinker that has gone past some of those ideas, and all I'm saying is that they should welcome other teachers' ideas. They should welcome...
Absolutely. That's a thinker. Thinker is always open to new ideas and to what anybody has to say, but they keep the right of accepting or not accepting the way they understand it.
Okay, I just wanted to hear what you said, yeah.
Right. That I heard from Rabbi Chait, okay? I'll take responsibility for any mistakes. Okay? This is this. If you just look at the written law, the five books, just the five books, there are five ways of relating to the five books, okay? Of course, only one is right. There are five different ways of relating to the five books, but, however, only one could be right, okay? Now, the first one is, the first way of relating to the Chumash is that it was written by man, but, however, so why should I study it? Because I could learn morals and ethics, okay?
Is that the reason why you should study it?
According to the people that say that it was written by a man, there's no God. God did not write it. But they still maintain that there is some validity in studying and quoting from Torah because you can learn morals and ethics.
Okay.
Now, I say that is impossible. I mean, really, Rabbi Chait saying, okay? But the thing is that it is impossible because it comes out that the author of the book, according to them, that hold that it was man-made, that man must be a liar and a cheat. He's a liar because it says that God spoke to Moses to command the children of Israel these laws. And that's a lie, according to them. And then he cheats because he obligates us to buy things like phylacteries and sacrifices and kosher meat and tzitzis. And the sukkah, all this cost money and energy, and I can't work on Saturday. So it comes out the guy is a liar and a cheat. So I want to know how you could learn morals and ethics from a liar or a cheat. That's the first, okay? The second way that people accept the Torah is they say, look, we have to keep some of the laws of Torah, like they'll keep kosher, you know what I mean? Or somehow they'll keep the Sabbath in some form or another, but they don't keep. They pick and choose what they keep of the Torah. They hold it was given by God, but they have the right to pick and choose what they keep. Okay. So the thing is, according to that position, it comes out that you are smarter than God. Why? Because God tells you you have to keep the 613 commandments. And they say we can pick and choose which one we want, so we know what is better. So they are smarter than their God. It's a strange God if you're smarter than your God, of course. Okay?
Right.
Right. The third way of accepting it is that you have to accept the total Torah, 100%. You can't just choose. But, however, you have the right to interpret it your way. Okay? Now, if you read, right, that's what they say, but you interpret, you know what I mean, according to the words. Like, for instance, I'll give you an illustration. In the Torah it says you're not permitted to have lights on the Sabbath. Now, according to us, it means that you're not allowed to put on or off lights on the Sabbath, or you can't start a fire on the Sabbath, but you can start one before the Sabbath as long as you don't maintain it on the Sabbath. That's why we have the right to put on the electric lights before the Sabbath. But however, according to them, they would say that that you can't put on lights at all. That's their interpretation. There was a group this way. I mean, every single possibility that I'm giving is a group, okay, of people that really, either in modern times or in past times, held this way. So therefore, it comes out that their God doesn't know how to teach. Why? Because he gives you information, and then he doesn't tell. Like, for instance, phylacteries. It says you should have it between your eyes. They put it literally between their eyes. Okay? But it doesn't explain, really, they can't even put on phylacteries either, because it doesn't even explain in the Torah what phylacteries are, how you make phylacteries. So the thing is, all these things, what the laws are, you would not know how to do it without some interpretation. But they say you have the right to interpret it any way you want. If that is true, then it comes out that your God doesn't know how to teach. He doesn't know how to express himself. He just expresses himself in a vague way and then says you do it. You understand? And each person could interpret it any way they want. You don't have any system. What's the value of it? He doesn't know how to... In other words, it's a God that doesn't know how to express himself. Can't teach. Okay?
Okay.
Rabbi, when you're talking about they, who is they again?
There are people that actually held these positions. There are people today that hold the position that that there's no God, but yet they preach from the pulpit morals and ethics based on the Torah. The second group, there is a group today that holds you could keep some laws and you don't have to keep the others as long as you keep some of them. And there was a group, not today, but many, many years ago, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, that did hold. They used to sit in the house in the dark. They did not put on lights. And when they put on phylacteries, they put it literally between their eyes. But the fact is, they wouldn't know what phylacteries are without the oral law. There's no place in the written law that really explains phylacteries. There's no place in the written law that explains how to build a sukkah booth on Sukkot. You know, none of the laws are really explained in detail there. You really can't keep anything. So therefore it comes out, according to them, that their God doesn't know how to teach. Okay?
Okay.
Now there's some people that say that God gave the Torah.
The four.
This is the fourth, right, they're five. That God gave the Torah, but however God changed his mind and he changed it and he created a New Testament.
Oh.
Right? There is that position, is that correct? Okay? Now according to this, it comes out that God is a bad thinker. Why? Because the laws are, in other words, what they say is that there is a new situation, and because of this new situation, you need a new system, right? But it comes out God made a set of laws that should, for the people, which should benefit the people, right? Now, if it's to benefit the people, it has to be based on human nature and not on situations. Human nature hasn't changed. since Noah, human nature hasn't changed.
Okay.
Well, really, since Adam, human nature hasn't changed.
It's gone.
So therefore, it comes out that God is a bad thinker. Why? Because he doesn't know how to make a law that fits the nature of the human, and it's only based on some vague situation. You see? In other words, if I'm making a law, it should be for the benefit of the human. But since since it's according to his nature, that's the way it would benefit him, so then that never changes. So how could you ever change it? But according, you understand, so therefore it comes out, God doesn't even know the nature of how to create a law that will fit the nature of a human being. So therefore, according to them, it comes out that he's a bad thinker. He doesn't know how to think correctly. So therefore, the only other one that's left, the fifth one, is that God must have given an explanation to the written law. And the only explanation that has come through the ages and has stuck there from as long as we can remember, and we even have the people that it was passed down with, the greatest thinkers of every generation, the only thing that we have is the oral law that explains the written law, and that would be the correct way of accepting the written law. Any questions? Okay, we're going to do Mishlei 21:11, and it says, when the lates is a type of fool, okay, we'll define a little bit later, is punished. By punished means that he gets his consequences. So the pesi, which is another type of fool, becomes wise. Okay? And when the chacham is instructed, when a wise student or a wise person, he gives instruction, instructed, he takes wisdom, he takes knowledge. Okay? The difference between the lates and the pesi is the lates is an intelligent person, but he lives basically according to his emotions. Okay? And the pesi is philosophically naive. Okay? Now, sometimes the word pesi is used for a person that has no background in philosophy. Sometimes the term pesi is used for a person that doesn't have the ability to get knowledge. Okay? So therefore, he has to be, by definition, he has to be intellectually naive. Okay? Right. Now, the thing is, a chacham, that is three levels of people. Okay? There is the wise person that creates ideas. He's able to create the ideas and see new ideas around him. That's one person. There's another person that can be taught ideas, but he can't create his own. He can be taught it. And there's some people that don't have the ability to understand an idea. Well, it has to be, everything has to be in descriptive form. Okay? Is that clear?
Right.
You got all three? Okay.
The third person can't be taught an idea, but what did you put as the disclaimer there?
I say that he can only understand things with his five senses.
Oh, okay, I understand.
Okay? I mean, he's not that he can't understand. He could understand something, but it has to be very descriptive. It's very hard for him to grasp a concept.
Got it.
Okay? Now, according to the Meiri, he wants to say that the second type of person that I mentioned, even though he can't create his ideas, but he could see an idea, is still considered a chacham. That's why he says when the chacham is instructed, when he has instruction, he takes knowledge because he can be instructed in ideas. You see? But the pesi could only be taught when he sees not only sees, I mean, you kind of, when, or you tell them a story about how a person had his consequences. So as he starts seeing many, many stories, it starts coming together the ideas of you know, how to live life. To a certain level, he could see things, he could put things together through the many, many different examples that are given to him. You
so
see?
What definition does that give to the
Leitz? The Leitz is an intelligent person. Question was, what's the definition of a Leitz? The Leitz is an intelligent person, but he lives the life of his desires. You understand? He's a person that's against reality. You understand? He doesn't want reality. So when he gets his consequences, you could show through many stories of different people, from history, from current events, from people around you. You start seeing things that's pointed out to him, or he starts seeing after a while these things, so he could learn from that, and he could straighten out his life to a certain extent. So the verse is telling us that there's three levels of study, and you have to know who you're working with and what level the person is on, how to educate. In other words, if the person is a creative person, well, then he should just go on and create things. There's not much you could tell him. I mean, even though he can learn new things, and if you tell him an idea, you might open his mind, but the fact is he's creative, he'll see things. Then the second level is that you could teach him ideas, but you have to show him all the ideas. It's very hard for him to be creative, or he's creative on a very low level. So basically, you have to show him all the ideas, and he could learn it that way. And the third person is through description only, and you can't give ideas. He wouldn't grasp an idea.
Well, the second level is probably the majority.
Well, you're probably right, Bill. You're probably right. The question that we enjoy is asking is that it seems so self-evident that that when the wise are instructed, of course, if he's wise, he's going to take knowledge. But according to the Meiri, it's pointing out that there's some people that can only gain through instruction and not through creativity. That's what the Meiri, but he's still called the Chacham because he could see an idea.
So who's in the category of the person who...
So it's not mentioned the creative person, right? It's not mentioned here. He would definitely be called a Chacham. You understand? He would definitely be called a Chacham. But we're saying also the category of Chacham is a person, according to the Meiri, is a person that could receive the knowledge. You see? You could receive ideas. But if you can't see things through ideas, if you don't see the ideas, then you can't be called a Chacham. Even though he becomes the Pesi becomes wisened because he knows how to act, and we would accept him, you know, as a good person and an intelligent person, but we won't give him the label of Chacham according to the way I understand the Meiri.
He's talking about these three types of people. He's not equating them to the first fool, the second fool, and the wise person in this verse.
No, he's only equating the Pesi and the second level of Chacham in this verse. And then he mentions the other level, which is not in this verse. And then, in other words, this verse is saying how to teach people. And certain people you could teach through ideas, and certain people you have to teach through stories.
Okay.
Right? If you have to teach him through stories, he's an intelligent person, but that he could learn. You understand that he has the ability to change his life and to lead a life of to protect himself, to live correctly to the best of his ability. But we can't call him a Chacham if he's not guided by ideas. That's the way I understand the Meiri.
What does it mean by being punished?
By punished, it means that he gets his consequences, because he'll do it. The Leitz does incorrect actions, and sooner or later he'll get his consequences.
Can you become wise and still be intelligent?
Well, he becomes wisened.
Can you be intelligent and not wise?
Yeah, I'm making that distinction. In other words, that you could become intelligent and learn how to live a correct life to a certain extent, because it can't be completely. He becomes wiser. You understand? He becomes wiser. Yechkam doesn't mean he becomes a wise person. He becomes wiser. You understand? But he never. But if you don't think, and if you can't understand ideas and think in terms of ideas, then you can't be defined as a wise person or a chacham.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or how that person is gaining anything at all.
The person that's punished is not gaining anything. He's just part of history or current events or somebody you know where he got consequences as a result of his actions. And therefore you learn from it. Let's put it this way, even a wise person could learn from that too. I'm not saying, but I mean that is the only way a Pesi could learn. A wise person, I mean, you know, we'll look at things, we'll look at history. Many times we'll use cases from history or current events to show ideas about about Torah, whatever we're discussing. But however, the Pesi can only understand things on the level let's put it this way, think of a young child, 5, even 10 years old, they can't understand ideas. You know, listen, the guy's unbelievable genius, but in general, they can't understand ideas. So you can only teach him through stories and guide him through stories. But ideas, sometimes, they can't grasp.
So the people watch this poor person that has the consequences and learn.
That's right. If a person that's a fool, I mean, that's all you can do is learn from him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, verse 12, it says, a tzaddik knows or understands the house of the wicked, and he turns or twists the wicked to evil. Okay? That's what the verse says. Now.
Is the wicked already evil?
Right. The thing is like this. According to the... this is according to Rabbeinu Yonah, the way he interprets it. Okay? He says that the tzaddik... A lot of people think that the tzaddik does not understand the wicked because he lives a righteous life. Okay? Now, the thing is, there are certain good people that they are naive and they don't understand the wicked. Them we don't call a tzaddik. That is not a real tzaddik. The tzaddik, you can only become a tzaddik through knowledge. And you can only become a tzaddik when you have the knowledge of wicked. Why? Because every human being has wickedness within them, right? Like I say, just say that a person is born wild, that he has everything wicked in him, like any wicked person. The only thing is he's guided by the mind. Now, the only way he could protect himself is to understand wickedness. So therefore, he studies wickedness from within himself, and he studies wickedness from the evil people. He tries to understand the wickedness and the different types of wickedness, the different ways that the evil inclination could bring him down. So therefore, the real tzaddik is not naive. I mean, a lot of people think a righteous person is a naive person. It's really not true. He has to know the nature of the wicked. That's the first half. Okay? Now, he understands the nature of the wicked enough to know that whenever a wicked person does anything, his purpose is wickedness. There's a statement in Pirkei Avos that you should try and judge a person towards zechus, towards merit. In other words, if you see a person do an act which seems to be evil, then if he's a righteous person, then you should interpret it. That you should try and work it out in such a way that it should be a just thing. In other words, the Rabbeinu Yonah says, if most of his actions are just. You see a person that most of his actions are just, then you see a questionable act, then you should try and work it out in such a way to interpret it according to justice. But if you know an evil person, then you know his base of drive is to evil. Like we said before, we did this the other day, that the nature of the wicked is he desires evil. Right? That's the nature of the wicked. So once you know that, and you see a person that most of his actions are evil, you understand, are foolish, then you don't have to judge him towards the merit side and towards trying to make it work out good, because you know his desire is to do the wrong thing. So therefore, he says, on the second half, he turns or twists the evil to the wicked person to evil. What it means, if he does an act which seems to be not nice, you should, he shows he'll only accept the possibility of evil and not good, because it's impossible for a person that's evil to do a nice act. By nice act, I mean just, yes.
I'm looking at Malvern, and...
In other words, the righteous knows the nature of the wicked to such an extent that he knows that anything he does, his purpose and his motive must be wicked. And the same thing with the fool, he'll know that the purpose and the motive of a fool is also to do foolishness. So therefore, he wouldn't try to work out with his two possibilities. And to show one of the possibilities is just, and maybe he had a just idea in mind, that's a foolish thing to do that, because the person is by nature to doubt to do evil. So therefore, you can't judge it in a meritorious way.
Righteous person as the judge of the wicked, and not to accept. A claim that he's doing something good.
Yes, because you can't change the nature of a person in an act. A person's nature changes, it takes years. Now, if a person is guided by his evil inclination, so then any act is guided by that evil inclination. Now, there's some people that are guided by ideas, and they're also guided by their emotions. That's a difficult one to call. Then you have to know most of his actions, and basically he's already mostly guided by the truth and ideas. So then you should, according to the Rabbeinu Yonah, then you should make your decision towards the meritorious.
I don't think too many of us run into that kind of situation, do we?
The question is, practically, how do you use this? I say yes. So you meet lots of people. And, the thing is, the good thing, what you should do, is always when anybody does an act, without looking at the motive, see if you could interpret it in context, either good and evil. A person should learn how to interpret things. Now, most people, that's why gossip or Lashon Hara is such an unbelievable constant, because everybody twists things to evil. Everybody wants to see evil in others, and so they constantly twist everything to evil. But it's a good training to show that maybe it's not that way, and then make a decision based on what your knowledge of the person is.
Okay.
The question is are you in the position to make that decision? The answer is yes. You have to make that decision based on the knowledge that you know of the person. I don't say you don't make mistakes, but you should make decisions. Why shouldn't you make decisions? You're judging a person. Yeah, you're judging. You have the right to judge. Why shouldn't you judge?
Because you don't know.
It's that you make decisions based on the information you have.
But yes, actions could not have that relevance towards you. Why do I have to make a decision based on
that? I'm not saying you have to make any decisions. I'm not saying you have to make a decision. I'm just saying that, first of all, sometimes you do have to. And secondly, you should learn to train yourself in general to know how to decide about a person. Okay?
Right.
And therefore, the knowledge is based on two things. There's certain times of fact. Person goes into the store, robs the store with a gun, and kills somebody. I mean, there's no other possibility. You know what I mean? Sometimes there is no other possibility. But many times, many situations where you look at the situation, trying to interpret it two ways. One towards evil, one towards good. Now, since there are two possibilities, then you make the decision based on your knowledge of the person. If the person is a wicked person, then interpret it towards wickedness. The person is a fool, and then you, especially if you know he's a fool, so then you interpret it towards foolishness. The person is a wise person or a righteous person, then you interpret it as such, if you could find that interpretation.
So to say,
So that's good information. I said, I think that many times we just don't make a decision on about people. We just kind of listen and let it go by. But I think that's interesting what you said.
Right, I think you should make decisions about people. That doesn't mean that your decision should remain that way all the time.
No.
Let's say you get new information, then you could change your decision. You know what I mean? Let's say you find out you judged him one way, and then you find out other things, and you find out that you judged him wrong.
Right.
So then you change. That's the constant development in your knowledge. Just don't be afraid of a mistake. Just correct your mistake. You want to say something?
Yeah, I think like a lot of times like a, you know, more religious-oriented person would think, oh, it's not up to me. I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to think about it, you know, because I don't want to be thinking bad things about other people. So the idea kind of comes like, you know what I'm saying? Like a lot of people will think that, like, who knows? I'm not going to think something good or bad about a person. Where this is really saying it. You're going to benefit yourself by, you have to make these calls in life, you have to make these different calls. Just in your practical dealings with how you're going to run your life. Are you going to do a business deal with this person? You have to make a decision on their character.
Okay, the question is that you could judge a person by what he says, and how he acts. Then the statement was made that you could judge a person by the consequences, okay? Now I'm saying I don't know if you could always judge them by consequences, because sometimes there are things that happen to a person that's bad in life, not as a result of consequences, but as a result of something else. You know, I mean, laws of nature. But if you see that it's a result of his actions, then yes, then the consequences would help define him. But if you cannot see it as a result of his actions, then you cannot tell. Hard to tell that, because it might be something in the laws of nature.